Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Rami Khoury, internationally syndicated columnist and the director of the Issam Farah's Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut, and editor-at-large for the Daily Star. In an article titled, "The Middle East's Freedom Train Has Just Left the Station," written just after the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt in 2011, Rami Khoury penned these lines.
We are witnessing the most significant Arab historical development, which is the spontaneous drive by millions of ordinary Arabs to finally assert their humanity, demand their rights, and take command of their own national condition and destiny. This is a revolt against specific Arab leaders and governing elites who have implemented policies that have seen the majority of Arabs dehumanized, pauperized, victimized, and marginalized by their own power structure. But it is also a revolt against the tradition of major Western powers that created the modern Arab states and then fortified and maintained them as security states.
Rami Khoury, I'm so happy to have you on Counterpoint to talk to us today about where the Arab freedom train, powered by what you like to call the Arab Citizens Revolt, is currently stationed. Welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Rami, let's set the stage for our understanding of the Arab revolts with a bird's eye view of the 100 years before Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in Tunisia in December 2010, sparking the Arab uprisings. Help us to understand in broad brushstrokes the backstory for the Arab uprisings across the Middle East.
The simple explanation for that is that most of the 22 Arab countries were created either by the handiwork of European colonial powers that were retreating in most cases from the region, or by local marauding chieftains and tribal leaders who took over territory and created a country. And these became formalized after World War I, most of them, and then after World War II. So by the 1950s or 60s, we had all these 22 Arab countries, none of which had been independent countries before, none of which had clear national identities, with the possible exception of Egypt, maybe parts of Yemen, but otherwise none of these countries had a history of a clear national identity, territorial integrity, a common history, a sense of community. But poof, they discovered they were suddenly countries with borders and passports and a central government and armies. And the state-building process went on okay from the 1940s till the 1980s, and most people were seeing their lives improved. But then by the 1980s, the state-building process started to stagnate. And in the last 30 years, the condition of most people in most of the Arab world, with a few exceptions, but I would say over 80% of people in the Arab world, found that their well-being was declining. They were getting poorer, they were politically more marginalized, they were at the mercy of autocratic rulers, families and armies ruled most of these countries. The ordinary citizen had no voice, had no say, had very few rights other than to be a consumer and a shopper and to go to a shopping mall and buy 6 cell phones. Other than that, most Arab people had really no sense of citizenship and their life condition was deteriorating. Their economic well-being was stressed. Their social condition was under constraints. Their political rights were almost non-existent. And that's the background to this situation where you had 60 million Arabs in around 1930, and you have about 350 million Arabs today, and the incredible demographic stress on this region, the political stress, social and economic stress, all of these things came together to create a situation where hundreds of millions of humiliated, dehumanized almost Arab people suddenly decided that they couldn't really take this anymore, and we had the citizen revolt.
You keep calling it a citizens' revolt. Throughout the West, it's oftentimes referred to as the Arab Spring. That's a term that you object to. Why?
I don't like the term the Arab Spring because, first of all, nobody in the Arab world ever called it an Arab Spring. It's a term that came out of the United States, mostly in Europe, I think. And they were looking at the Prague Spring and the European Spring and Western traditions. I don't like it because spring gives it the idea that this is a seasonal one-time event that is suddenly going to move into a nice summer. It takes away the agency of individuals and what they're doing. It doesn't capture the complex reasons for the disenchantment of millions and millions of people. And it certainly doesn't capture their determination to struggle, even at the cost of death, which has happened to hundreds of thousands of people, to struggle for their rights. And I mostly don't like the term because it's not a term that the people themselves who are fighting for their rights use. Most people in the Arab world who are involved in these uprisings or revolts or revolutions, mostly they talk about revolution, which is Thawra in Arabic, or uprisings, Intifada. They're uprisings and they're revolutions in the eyes of the people themselves, and therefore I think that's what we should call them.
You began, as you gave us the backstory of what resulted in these uprisings, to talk about some of the causes. Can you amplify that? What are some of the key causes of the Arab citizens' revolt?
There isn't a single cause, but it's the coming together of different stresses and discontents that influence or impact on the lives of, I would say, 250 out of the 350 million Arabs. The vast majority of people in the Arab world have virtually no political rights whatsoever. They're not involved in any process of accountability of their government, of their power structure. They have no way to really express themselves seriously, to hold power accountable. So at the political level, they're totally voiceless and helpless, and they don't count, they don't matter, they don't exist. They're invisible people in the eyes of their own power structure. To add to that, you have the indignities of economic stress, where most people are becoming poorer, having to do anything possible, including sometimes criminal activity, to just get enough money to feed their kids. Social services for the vast majority of people in the last 30 years have been declining, healthcare, education, water. And all of this is after that period from the 1940s to the 1980s, when actually things were getting better. So there was a developmental phase in modern Arab history when life was getting better. So you didn't have popular revolutions. You had occasionally a colonel who overthrew another colonel, you know, like happened with Saddam Hussein, or a colonel who overthrew a king, like in Libya. But you didn't have mass uprisings because the majority of people were finding their lives were improving until around the 1970s or 1980s. And now we've seen the 30 years of pressure and regression causing the sentiments that led to the uprisings. You have a third factor, which is not just you have the internal political autocracy, the police state system of governance, and the economic and social stress, but you have the third factor, which is external humiliation, Israeli colonization, attacks against the neighboring Arab countries by Israel, American, British attacks against Iraq and other places, the drones attacks. Now, this constant, never-ending problem of foreign armies that target or attack or somehow get involved in the Middle East, including more recently Iran in Syria, which is another foreign actor, not from the West, but from the East, and the Russians, what they're doing in Russia. So there's this third element, which is nagging, perpetual anger and helplessness in the face of foreign powers that use their power to do whatever they want to do in the Middle East for their purposes, but totally disregarding the rights and sentiments of the local people here. So those three factors that came together and finally caused this explosion. Why it happened in December 2010 with Mohamed Bouazizi's mistreatment in Sidi Bouzid in rural Tunisia is really a matter of history. It's, you know, why did Rosa Parks do what she did in Montgomery, Alabama? Why did Lech Walesa do what he did in 1980 in Gdansk Shipyard in Poland to start the revolt that brought down the Soviet Union 10 years later? Steve Biko, Mahatma Gandhi, these individuals who unleashed a mass change in their countries one day when they decided to do something. And that one day, you can never predict when that one day is going to come, but you can almost always predict that it will come. And many people in the Arab world saw this coming. Nobody could tell where or when it would start, but there was such extensive discontent and dehumanization that it was obvious that the system was not sustainable, and now we see it wasn't.
So Mohamed Bouazizi's self-immolation, that was the trigger. What you've been telling us is that there was a powder keg underneath this that resulted in a popular explosion or popular revolutions. But to be sustained, they have to be organized. And in the West, we've heard a lot about the social media elements of this. Tell us a little bit more broadly, though, about the way in which the Arab uprisings have been organized on the ground. Since I worry that some of our fascination with this is also about our fascination just with technology and doesn't get at some of the ways in which this has been a popularly mobilized revolution of peoples.
The technology was important and continues to be important in places like Syria, for instance. But the technology played an important catalytic role in a very important moment early on in Egypt and in Tunisia. It allowed people to express themselves. It allowed people at the local level to broadcast what they were feeling and what they were doing. And this was immediately picked up by the international Arab satellite stations like Jazeera and Arabiya. And it wasn't just national revolts in each country. This was a regional uprising. And people watched all over the Arab world. I remember those 2 weeks of the end of December and the beginning of January 2011. People were mesmerized wherever they were. They were turning on Jazeera to see what was going on in Tunisia, because suddenly people in the streets were no longer afraid of the police states that had kept them pacified and dehumanized. And they saw not just the courage and determination of the people in Tunis who were demonstrating. People immediately, of course, identified with that all over the Arab world. They knew exactly what Tunisians were feeling and doing. That resonated widely with hundreds of millions of Arabs, but people watching this all over the region were also buoyed by the fact that the Tunisian regime proved to be a paper tiger, that these guys that we thought were a strong police state were actually a bunch of chickens, and they got on their plane and fled to Saudi Arabia, and then the same thing happened in Egypt. In other cases, people fought back, like in Libya and in Syria and in Yemen and Bahrain, and so you had different reactions from different regimes. But it was the mass courage and determination of millions of ordinary people on the streets that was really the driving force. The social media helped a little bit at the very beginning, but the analogy I give is that, you know, social media is like Paul Revere's horse. And the horse is important, the social media is important, but it's the rider who's on the horse and the people using the social media who are the real agents of change and the people who have the real courage. And it's their sentiment and their acts that will resonate throughout history.
What have been some of the key watchwords of the revolution? What is it that people are fighting for on the streets?
They're fighting for a bunch of abstract nouns: dignity, social justice, a voice, respect, life, freedom. It's these abstract nouns that they keep talking about. And you see this all the time, and still today, social justice, dignity, respect are very much in the news and in the air as people struggle to make the transition in some countries, to cement and institutionalize the gains they've made in others like Tunisia. But these abstract nouns reflect a series of practical deficiencies and needs and rights. So when people talk about dignity or social justice, and we're studying these factors in our institute at the American University of Beirut, we have regional projects to analyze and research what people mean by social justice and dignity. But behind these abstract nouns, there are things like decent social services, affordable housing, affordable food, treating people equitably when they go to a government agency to carry out a normal routine task, not having to be asked to bribe somebody just with maybe a dollar only, but to make a bribe to get a service that is your right as a citizen, like to renew your passport or get a telephone line or something. Things like job opportunities, not to abuse power by the police force or the ruling business interests. So all of these practical day-to-day needs of people, these are the ultimate goals of the uprisings. But people articulated all these realities and these practical needs, socioeconomic, political. They articulated them in the language of abstract nouns like dignity and social justice. So it's really important to understand what those things actually mean.
And obviously the difficult part is in part where we are now, and we'll pick this up, which is how do you translate that into constitutions? How do you institutionalize those abstract nouns? If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to internationally syndicated journalist Rami Khoury about the Arab uprisings. When you talk about the Arab revolts, you remind American audiences that it took 300 years to transition from slavery to civil rights and women's rights, and that what's taking place in the Middle East, therefore, compresses hundreds of years of revolution, civil war, civil rights and citizen struggles into just a few years. Help us to connect the massive changes at work in the Middle East with our own historical processes. Can you draw out some of these parallels?
Yes, and when you look at Western Europe, where, for instance, it took 500 years to go from the Magna Carta to the French Revolution, or the United States, where it took a couple of hundred years to finally get black people to get their rights fully. The beginning of democratic pluralistic governments in, say, France or the United States began with only land-owning white people basically having rights. Black people, women, many other people in society had no rights at all. And it took a long time and included wars and civil wars and protests and mass movements. It took a long time for the Western world to gradually give the promise of democracy and equality to all of its citizens. And that process happened gradually because it was a process that was spearheading the transition to pluralistic democracy for the entire world. I mean, nobody globally had ever had a republic based on the concepts of total freedom and total equality for all citizens and the consent of the governed anchored in the rule of law. Those were all, you know, pioneering new concepts. So when they started in the 1770s in the United States, they had this ringing Declaration of Independence, but of course black people and Native Americans and women had no rights, no voting, nothing. Slowly, people realized that there was a problem between the promise of the Constitution and the reality of the lives of ordinary people. So gradually, in Western democracies, these issues were addressed one by one. Slavery ended, and then black people got more rights, and then women got more rights. And you had cases, for instance, in the US and Europe where there was rampant anti-Semitism. Jews were badly treated and denied their rights in many cases, leaving alone the horror of the Holocaust. But just in the United States, for instance, in 1920, it was pretty rough being a Jewish person in the East Coast in the big cities because there was anti-Semitism. So all these things were addressed one after the other. Now we're still dealing in the United States with the rights of gay and lesbian people and immigrant people. And so it's a never-ending struggle to really iron out all the wrinkles in democracies that are partial in delivering their promises and to make them complete in actually giving the promise of freedom and equality to all people. So that process has played itself out in Europe and the US and other democracies around the world. So we don't need 200 years, but we certainly need more than 2 or 3 years to make the transitions ourselves, because even if you're living in a country where there's, for instance, decent education opportunities, even though the systems are not always good quality, but most people in the Arab world, despite the problems I mentioned, most people can still walk to get clean water or get it in their homes or walk to a health center if they need immunization shots or something. So there is a basic minimum level of services that have reached people, but people have never had a chance to participate in any kind of democratic process. So when we saw in Egypt and other countries in the Arab world, the transition starting to happen 3 years and 3.5 years ago, you know, it was messy and it was chaotic, but people had never done this before. They'd never written a constitution themselves. You know, the American Constitution also was a mess. The first American Constitution was a laughable document and it didn't work. And there was almost a return to war in the United States until 10 years later, they got together again and fixed it up. And even then they needed to have all these extra articles and amendments made. So, you know, even the great American democracy started out as a laughable process until it was fixed up 10 years later. And the same thing's going on right now in Egypt and Libya. And so the early years are difficult because people who've never practiced democracy, constitution writing, legislative compromises, writing bills and laws, debating these things, these are processes that people learn by doing. You don't take a pill and suddenly learn how to run a political party or organize a mass social movement. So it takes time, and we're in that early stage of that process where people are just learning to do this. And I think we'll see the difference in the next Egyptian elections, for instance. You're going to see much more sophisticated mobilization, organization by different groups, especially the opposition groups, who learned their lesson that they were too fragmented in the last few elections in Egypt, and therefore the Muslim Brothers won, or now the army and Sisi won. So I think you're going to see a more sophisticated approach by opposition groups, secular groups, progressive and nationalist groups. And this will show that they've learned their lesson from the last 3 or 4 years. So I'm hopeful, but I understand that this process is going to take time. We don't need 200 years, but we probably need 10 or 20 years to get into really credible democratic participatory systems of some sort.
So you keep emphasizing democratic participatory systems, representative government, constitutions, citizens' rights, equality before the law. This is all the language of liberalism, the Enlightenment values on which America and other democratic societies are formed. Are you translating an Arab experience into the liberal idiom, or is the liberal idiom the watchwords on the street?
I think neither completely I'm doing. I think what I'm trying to say is that the fundamental values of ordinary Arab men and women all across the region, which are now very well documented by social surveys, polling, the World Value Surveys, there's all kinds of evidence now, which we didn't have 20 years ago. But we have it now, and the evidence shows that the fundamental values of people across the Arab world coincide very clearly with the basic tenets of what you call liberalism, or what I would call participatory democracies as practiced in the West, whatever we want to call them. We're talking about the same thing. And what I mean by these values, things like equality, rule of law, accountability, opportunity, justice, the fundamental building blocks of a democratic, pluralistic, republican kind of system. Even there's a strong sense among people in the Arab world that they don't want religious people running their government. They want religious values to shape society, like mercy, honesty, fraternity, and those what they see as the best religious values in predominantly Islamic societies here. But people don't want religious people to run the country, like in Iran, for instance. So even in that sense, it's not secularism, but it's a separation of church and state to some extent. So that's where I feel that what the Arab people are doing, and each one does it slightly different in its own country, because the 22 Arab countries have different social traditions, economic conditions, historical memories, etc. But across the board, what you're seeing is people who want to be treated decently by their own power structure. They don't necessarily want to run the government themselves, but they want their concerns to be listened to. They want their voices to be heard. They don't want to see unchecked autocratic power, abuse of power, people in government sitting there for 30 years at a time and being reelected with 95% of the vote in these comic elections. We've just had four of them in the Arab world, in Egypt, in Syria, in Algeria, and Iraq. Iraq was less comic, but the result is the same, that they have a dysfunctional parliament, because these elections were just done by the Americans after they occupied Iraq in 2003, without really considering the local values, the local traditions, etc. They just created a governing system and an election system that has been totally ineffective. And Iraq is in a much worse condition now than it was 5-6 years ago. So all across the region, we're seeing when people just have imposed on them Western institutions, they don't work very well. But when people from the ground up shape their own system and bring together universal values with their indigenous values, things have a much better chance of taking root. Participation and accountability, to me, are the two critical elements. How people define them, if you do one person, one vote, if you decide to have in societies like Libya or Yemen, which are very tribal, you might end up not having one person, one vote. You might end up having a national tribal council of the heads of major tribes who themselves could be chosen by their own people. You might have regional government where you have tribal leaders who get together and then they elect people to a national assembly. There's different ways to do this. As long as the majority of citizens feel that their voices are heard, their concerns are taken into consideration, and the people who wield power do not abuse that power, but use power to serve their communities. Those are really the cornerstones, participation and accountability. And if those are implemented, then I think we'll have much more stable societies all across the Arab world, more productive societies, more humane societies. And I'm sure this will happen, but it will happen slowly and gradually over many years.
So let's talk a little bit more about what may result in the dragging of this out. That is, some of the tensions that would result directly from participation, because this is not only a compressed process, but it's also filled with tensions, identity conflicts, ideological differences, local, national, and regional pressures. Tell us about some of the conflicts, actually, that are playing out as different voices get involved in the process, different ideologies come to bear on trying to determine exactly how you translate those abstract nouns into institutional forms.
As far as I can see in the last 3.5 years since the uprisings began, but also looking back over the last 30, 40 years, which I've lived through in the region here, I sense that there are a series of balances that need to be struck. For instance, we have to find the right balance between religiosity and secularism. And I don't know where the balance is going to be, if it goes more to religion or more to secular governance. People themselves have to make that definition, or you can have more religiosity at the local level, at your local community, but more secularism in the national federal government, maybe. The Tunisians are the only people who've actually gone through this process in a credible way, and they came up with a constitution which hasn't really defined that definitively. They talk about the role of religion in Islam, but they also talk about that the decisions, laws will be made by the people. So they're still struggling with this to find that balance. Another balance is between military rule and civilian rule. Military rule has been with us since the 40s or 50s in most Arab countries, and this has proved to be a catastrophe. It's the single most detrimental factor to the non-development of the modern Arab world in the last 30 years. The military-led governments that have run the Arab countries in most cases have been incompetent at national development and have opened up the floodgates to corruptions, misuse of funds, abuse of power. So therefore, people respect the military at the national level. They like the armed forces because they think they protect them. They're safeguarding the country. But they don't want any more military men to rule countries. And so that balance has to be defined. The third balance I would see is one between tribal and sectarian identity and national identity. So you have a country like Syria, which is composed of Sunni Muslims, Alawites who are close to the Shiite Muslims. You have Kurds, you have Christians, you have Assyrians, you have Druze. There's all these other small numbers of Kurds and the different numbers of different nationalities, different identities, different ethnicities. And these people suddenly found themselves all to be citizens of Syria. None of them had any say in creating Syria or having a choice to be Syrian or not Syrian. It was just something that they inherited from French colonialism. And therefore, the process of coming to a consensus about what is the national identity, what are the rights of the citizens of that country, how do you reconcile different ethnicities and religious identities and other things, the rights of the citizen, the responsibility of the state, the limits of state power, all of these big sticker items that ultimately shape a country and make it run well, hopefully, have never been discussed by ordinary Arab people. Never have you had ordinary citizens do what the Tunisians did in the last 2 years, which is debate and talk about and adjust and finally agree and validate their own constitution. Tunisia is the place where the Arab revolt started, and now it's the first place to make the transition to a constitution crafted by its own people. This is the most exciting development, I would say, in the last 7,000 years of history in these countries. The citizens of a country crafted their own constitution, defined their national values, shaped their national governance institutions, created a balance between the citizen rights and the state's role. And of course, this has to be put into practice, but this is so exciting because it's never ever happened before, and hopefully it'll spread to other countries as well. But there's a lot of work that has to be done for countries to address these items, negotiate them, and come to some kind of consensus that's fair to everybody. It can definitely be done. People have done this for thousands of years, say at the local level, where you have local communities with different ethnicities, different religions. They have a very clear modus vivendi. They get along and things are defined. It's not always fully on the basis of equal rights and historical conditions, but this mechanism of negotiating a social contract or negotiating a political system, the allocation of power, the exercise of authority, the rights of citizens, these things have been going on for thousands of years at very local level. Now we're talking about doing them at the country level.
So, Rami, you've talked a lot here about tribal and ethnic versus national differences, religious versus secular, military versus civilian. You haven't talked as much about ideological differences across the spectrum, from Western imported notions of liberalism or even communism to pan-Arabism and to Islamism. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of those ideological differences are also going to factor into what ends up getting shaped as these citizens' revolts move forward?
You're talking about the Islamist movements like the Muslim Brothers, or you're talking about the extremists like Al-Qaeda?
I guess I'm talking about all of them. Say a little bit more about how some of the ideological differences are going to impact the process.
Well, I would say, first of all, that I don't think these are real ideologies. When you're talking about, say, the Muslim Brothers, or you're talking about the infinitesimally small numbers of extremists who are involved in Qaeda-like extremist groups, though, even though these groups are growing now in Iraq and Syria and places where there's zones of chaos, they're still very, very small. But these are not real ideologies. These are identities that people retreat into in times of stress and distress. When things are flourishing, these Islamist movements tend to die down. When times are rough, these Islamist movements grow very quickly. And this is a universal norm. The civil rights movement in the United States, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, the rights movement in South America were all led by churches. And that was because there was no possibility for civilian political movements to lead national drives for civil rights and equality, so the churches stepped in. That's the role of religion. When Caesar crushes you, you can turn to God. And that's something that you can't take away from people. And that's why the Muslim Brothers and other religious groups in the Islamic world have grown to be important and powerful in the last 30, 40 years, because they had no other opportunity. Citizens had no other way to express themselves, to demand their redress of grievance, to articulate their aspirations, and just to practice their ordinary rights as citizens, so they turned to these religious groups. So I don't see them as ideologies, I see them as identities that have a natural role in challenging authority and proposing transformational steps towards a more just and equitable society. And I think what you'll see is, as societies start to transform, and we may see this in Tunisia in the next couple of years, when you get more democratic and participatory systems, when you get economic growth with some social justice, the role of these religious groups will decline rapidly. But they have been very prominent, the Muslim Brothers, especially in groups like them all across the region. And not just in the Arab world. You see this in Iran, you see it in Turkey, you see it in Indonesia, you see it in many countries in Pakistan, where the majority of people are Muslims. But you also see it in other countries with other religions. So I wouldn't think of these as ideologies, but rather kind of social movements. They're natural human responses that draw on religion as the last resort response and refuge when people are addressing a dire situation in their own community.
So Rami, you told us immediately as the Arab citizens' revolts began to be unleashed that the freedom train had left the station. Help summarize where you see things now. Has the movement been derailed? Is that what we've seen most recently in Egypt? Or is the freedom train still on the move? Where is it on its journey?
It's not one train now. I would talk more about maybe a better analogy now to use is a flotilla of ships. Because we couldn't tell back in December 2010 and February 2011 when things started to happen. We had no idea where this was going, but it was clear, and I said so then, that there are going to be different conditions and different outcomes in different countries. But like the transformation of the Soviet Empire 30 years ago, some of those countries are democratic, some of them are halfway there, and some of them are terrible, corrupt police states. So I think we're going to see the similar fate in the Arab world. Some democracies, some autocracies will hang on, and others will be somewhere in the middle. But I think now what we have is a whole series of experiences in different Arab countries, each one moving in a slightly different direction and at a different speed. But what's driving them all is the same common sentiment, human sentiment, of millions of ordinary people who are fed up with being treated like idiots or sheep by their own governments, let alone by Israeli occupiers and colonizers or American and British invading forces or Iranian and Russian external threats that come at them. They're fed up with all this, and they don't want to put up with it anymore, and they risk their lives to live in a better situation. The revolutions and the uprisings that happened were quite spontaneous. Nobody had a prepared manifesto or an agenda. These were not unified movements, and there was exhilaration in the beginning when some regimes were overthrown, and then the hard work started of transition, and then you had the counter-revolutions, culminating now in the election of the armed forces head in Egypt to be the next president. So this is very troubling for many Egyptians, but you're going to see all kinds of things happening in Egypt in the next year where the spirit of Tahrir Square, the spirit of masses of ordinary men and women struggling for their fundamental decency and dignity and humanity, that spirit is still alive. At the same time, these are human beings. They're not machines. They're not cars that can run for a year straight as long as you keep giving them oil and gas. They get tired, they get scared. If they don't have jobs, they've got to focus on how do they feed their kids. If they just graduated from high school or college, they can't hang around 3-4 years without work. So there are pressing material realities that come into play, and many people in Egypt now have said, look, we want to have our rights, we still feel the spirit of Tahrir Square, but we've got to get money. We can't afford to live anymore. We can't buy food. We can't pay rent. Our kids are growing up. They need jobs. So there's a sense of fear among many Egyptians, partly because of the way the Muslim Brotherhood mishandled their incumbency of 1 year, partly at the fear of chaos and troubles in society and gas shortages, electricity cutouts, and things like that. So people are scared, and they're willing to slow down the march towards viable democracy if they can increase the process of regaining some of the socioeconomic material needs of their daily lives. So we're going to see this happening all the time, where human beings are going to react like human beings. They need food, they need housing, they need schooling, healthcare. And if they feel that they can get those things by bringing the army back into power, they will do that. But even when the army comes back to power, there's going to be a standard of accountability now that is much, much higher than it was when Mubarak was in power. But I predict that in Egypt you're going to see big revival of social movements who would have learned the lessons of the last 3.5 years, that they can't just be romantic and idealistic and think that they can do stuff on social media and appear on satellite TV and change the world. They're going to change the world by organizing, by mobilizing, by planning, by strategizing, getting people out into the streets, but also getting people into think tanks where they can come up with policy ideas, blueprints for new things to be done. So people understand now much better how to bring about change than they did 3.5 years ago. So I would anticipate more coherence, better articulated calls for change and for political transformation in the years ahead.
Rami Khoury, thanks so much for helping us to have this broader understanding of this momentous historical transformation that's taking place in the Arab world. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jonathan. My pleasure to be with you.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.